Comparing the life of the Prophet and his seerah, and by his seerah, what we mean is that his involvement in history. And as we go through these events and historical incidents that happened one after another, is shaping the environment for the people and the people in that area, in that region, to better accept the message of the Prophet. Before any announcement can be made, before any declaration must be made, the hearts of the people must be adjusted, they must be grown, they must be molded in order that people submit to it. If a person has a new idea and just wants to give the idea out, you see, people don't accept it because it's too radical, it's too drastic for someone to accept something right out of the blue. This only happens with people who are either highly intellectual and are able to see deeply into things, and though or those who have gone through situations in their life where their hearts are ready to accept the truth. That's why even now you see people who accept Islam. You will see there are two types of people who will accept Islam now in America. They're either the people who are highly intellectual, who look deeply into things and do their research, and they truly objectively see what's right and wrong, and then they reach the conclusion that this is right, that Islam is right, that one God is right, and hence they come towards that. Then the other type of people are those who have gone through a very drastic situation, who have gone through a history of victimization and oppression, that now their hearts and minds are ready to accept the truth when they see it. That's why you see these two groups of people accepting Islam right now. Because Islam being a new idea, not everyone is going to just accept it. It is something that is foreign to the thinking of the people in this land. And hence, many Muslims who go out there, who obviously not knowing what their message is going to sound like to the people, they go out there with good intentions in trying to explain Islam to the people, and they spend a lot of money doing that. They do tabligh and dawah and doing that, or for example, they have, you know, like billboards like Why Islam, 1-800 Why Islam billboards all over the place, you know. And then when you actually call them, if you have not done so, have you ever done or tried to call that number? Right, you know, I did. Yes, you know, I was bored that day. So I did call that number and, you know, ask them a random question to which I was given a runaround, you know. So the issue is that here you have people who don't know how to translate the ideas of Islam into the language and the frequency, the mind frequency of the people here. And hence they speak it in a language or they say it in a way that is not understood. The people are not going to be impressed by what you say. And sometimes, you know, we need to see the right terminology, the right method of actually reaching out to the people. It doesn't work like that. That's the reason. First, there must be grassroots work done. The initial people who will come into Islam, who would approach Islam or become Muslim, would be very few and very rare, And these are people, as I said, who belong to the two groups of people that I mentioned. Other than that, you will not get people who are just living their lives here, normal, ordinary people, to just come and accept Islam as it is. This is the same situation when the Prophet is coming. If the Prophet came without Allah creating an environment of thought and thinking by which people will actually be thinking before the Prophet comes, then the Prophet would say whatever he wants, it would never be understood by the people. The first thing was for him to create the grounds. And that's what we are looking at in the history right now. How the grounds are being prepared for the Prophet to come and to give his message and for his message to be accepted. So this is what we are learning and going through in the ancestors of the Prophet. Till we come to this point that the Prophet is 6 years old and he has just witnessed the death of his mother. Now, obviously Allah did not want his parents to be alive and to live with the Prophet, or the Prophet to live with them, because of the responsibility and the fact that the obligation that a child has to his parents, Allah did not want that obligation on anyone. I mean, that the Prophet should not be obligated towards anyone. He did not want the messenger who has come, as the title says, Rahmatan lil Alameen, a mercy unto mankind. He's a mercy unto mankind. He is the source of mercy for everyone. No one can be a mercy unto him. He is the blessing on everyone. No one can bless him. That's why you see that the existence of the Prophet and his history is blessing everything that he touches. Wherever the Prophet goes, he's being blessing others. The lives of people are being changed. Societies are prospering, becoming richer and wealthier. This is happening because Allah wants everyone to be indebted. Indebted. Just like, for example, Allah has made a whole nation indebted to Yusuf. Yusuf was sold as a slave. Now Allah wanted everyone to become a slave of Yusuf, to be indebted to Yusuf. And he changed the history like that. So this is how you see, in this sense, that the last prophet, the final messenger, the one who is going to be the king of all kings, the ultimate message and example of Allah, that example cannot have a flaw of having someone say to him that you owe me, that you that are obligated towards me. I helped you. If I wasn't there, then you wouldn't be like this. My friends, even the ancestors of the Prophet, they went through sacrifices in order to protect the seed and the light of the Prophet. They never claim that they have done something for the Prophet. In fact, you will see at the end of the speech that they declare that yes, it is not we who have done sacrifice for the Prophet. It is not we who have done something for the Prophet. Whatever we went through, we owe this to the Prophet. We are indebted to the Prophet. His own ancestors are saying this. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So now when the Prophet sees his mother pass away, and after that he comes under the guardianship of his grandfather, Abdul Muttalib. Abdul Muttalib, he takes over the guardianship of the Prophet, and from that time onwards, now you see that wherever Abdul Muttalib goes, you see that the Prophet is with him. Wherever you see Abdul Muttalib, you will see the Prophet there. Wherever you see the Prophet, you will see Abdul Muttalib around him. He would not let go of him. He would not separate from him. That's how close he was to the Prophet. So close he was. Not because this is a grandson of mine. Abdul Muttalib had many grandsons. He had many grandchildren. He had many relatives. And this is not because of that. As you will understand in their ideology and their belief system that Abdul Muttalib had, and after him his successor Abu Talib had, you will see that in their ideology they looked at the Prophet as different from their children, different from their grandchildren, different from their nephews. They viewed the Prophet as someone that they belong to, that they owe their existence to. They see the Prophet as the promised messenger that has been told to them by their great ancestors, Ibrahim and Ismail. This is what they view them as. And you will see that as they went along. Well, very few times did Abdul Muttalib ever leave the Prophet. That's why every place Abdul Muttalib used to go, he used to take the Prophet. On one such trip that he was taking towards, and he went to Sham and other places, and to a place, you know, near Jaffa, he went there on a certain trip where the Prophet, he had an illness in his eyes. A sickness of the eyes, his eyes were hurting. And for that reason, Abdul Muttalib was not in Mecca. So he went to go and see a monk who was known for medicinal care also. Like a wise person who knows herbal medicine. This was very big in those days. People, when they get sick, they used to go to a medicine man who would give them herbal medicine, and that medicine would cure them. He thought that he would go to this monk's place and he would get cure from him. Then obviously, Abdul Muttalib knows better than this. He understands the whole situation. He brings the Prophet because he feels a providence happening, destiny happening, and Allah's guidance coming through. Now, in the meanwhile, while he's going there, which I will explain that situation that happened when he went there, the small caravan that there was there, it was himself, Abu Talib, and the Prophet, who was only 6.5-7 years old at that time. 7 years old at that time. When he came to this place, the Christian monk, was inside that place of his worship. He had been there for many years. And once the Prophet came there near, he saw the monk felt that his place of worship shook as if it was an earthquake. He looked around to see what happened. And then as he opened the window, he saw a light come inside the window. He looked out to see where the light is coming from. He saw that it was coming from this caravan, this small caravan on top of a camel on a horse, that the carriage of the horse that was carrying the Prophet. He saw that light and obviously he was mesmerized by it. He knows history, he knows the books, he has read it, he has seen it, he has seen the signs about it, he read the signs about it also. But he was shocked to see it at his door. So he came down there, opened the door, Abdul Muttalib comes in with the Prophet. And he says, "What can I do you for?" Abdul Muttalib says, "Well, we are here to see if you, my grandson, has an illness in the eyes. He is hurting, if you can help him." The monk, the Christian monk, smiles at Abdul Muttalib, almost like a laugh, and he says, "Are you joking with me? Are you joking with me?" He says, "Why would we joke with you?" He says, "Listen, the child that you have is the one who cures illness for everyone. You're asking me to cure him?" He's salawat Allah. Your grandson is the one who's going to cure the world. He's here to give a cure to the whole world, and you're asking me. I'm just glad that he's here in my place. I am just blessed that I can see him. And then he went on to just praise the prophet. Praise him. He says, you don't know what you have with you. And Abdul Muttalib obviously was happy to hear that. Abdul Muttalib already knows that, and he saw that the eyes of the prophet are already cured. Right? He's feeling well. It was a matter that Allah wanted them to bide their time by going to this place. This place was in Jaffa. If you know where Jaffa is, Jaffa is a place, one of the miqat of Hajj where you wear ihram. Those who go to Hajj from outside through Jeddah to the airport of Jeddah, they need to go to Jaffa in order to wear the ihram, and from there they can go into Makkah. A lot of times nowadays what happens, people avoid that, people don't go that, and they say that you can wear your ihram in Masjid al-Tan'im. Masjid al-Tan'im, or also known as Masjid Aisha, is not the place for ihram for those who are coming from outside of that region. For those who live in Makkah, they can go to Masjid Aisha to wear the ihram. And that's why a lot of people who go for Hajj, they will wear ihram there for their Umrah Mufrada. They will go to Masjid Aisha, wear the ihram, and come back and do the Umrah. But when you want to go to Hajj or Umrah from outside of that region, and you come from outside anywhere, and you land in Jeddah, you have to go to Jaffa. This person, this monk, lived in Jaffa. Nowadays, it's just a barren land. It has been made barren, and all the people have been evacuated from there in order that people don't go there that much. The reason they are banning that, or they banished the people, or they slowly took the population out of that area, which used to be a thriving city at one time, a thriving town at one time, but now you go, it is empty, it's barren, hardly anyone lives there. The only reason you would go there is so that you can go and wear your ihram and go away. There are no shops over there, there's nothing, just that small little masjid now they made for the miqat and the ihram that is sold over there. That's the only thing that's available there. And the reason that they destroyed the city, or they evacuated and banished the people from there over time, is because Jaffa is very close to Ghadir Khum. No, they knew that if we allow the people to come to Jaffa, if that becomes migrated, if it becomes populated, then people will start going to Ghadir also. And in order to stop the people from going to Ghadir, they destroyed the city of Jaffa and now made it into a barren land that is now not more than a rest stop on the highway. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. So now this whole situation is happening. Jaffa, they go to Jaffa. Now Allah wants them to go to Jaffa because what's happening is this. In the meanwhile, while they're out there in Jaffa, Abdul Muttalib and that, there is a king that has taken over Makkah. There's a king that has taken over Makkah. It is the king of Yemen. The new king of Yemen has taken over Makkah. Obviously, he's someone who came there, did not want to destroy the Kaaba or anything. He was a new king. Because what happened after Abraha died, you know, Abraha was from the Christian guard that came from Ethiopia, right? He was from the Christian guard that came from Ethiopia, so the Christians were in charge. Before that, the Jews were in charge, which was Bu Nevas. You heard the story about that. Before that, the Yemen was ruled as a state of the Persian Empire. Now obviously when Bu Nevas took over, the Jews took over that, and after that the Christians invaded and they destroyed Bu Nevas, and then Abraha, and then after Abraha his successors were there. So now finally it came back into the hands of the local Yemenis under the power of the Persian Empire. The name of the ruler, his name was Saif. Saif was the ruler, King Saif. And he remained the king of Yemen until Islam came to Yemen. And that's when this kingdom was finished. When Islam came to Yemen and Imam Ali arrived there, and he was the one who was, you would say, the teacher of the Yemenis. Right? And in that time period, when this was happening, Saif took over. So as Saif took over Yemen with the help of the Persian Empire, so when it was taken over by him, he said, well, while we're at grabbing things, let's also grab Makkah. So he grabs Makkah and says, okay, Makkah is under my rule now. He just declares it. He doesn't hurt anyone, no war, no nothing. He just comes there and makes an announcement near the Kaaba. Hey, listen, I'm the new ruler here. If anyone has a problem, come and meet me. You know. And now Abdul Muttalib is not in town. He's the chief of Makkah. And everyone else is like, okay, you know, I mean, we have been taken over. You know, it wasn't as if anything changed. Right? Everything remained the same. It's just that he took over. Right? So when Abdul Muttalib came back, he heard that, hey, Makkah has been taken over. So like, who, where, what? You know, anything damaged, what happened here? No, nothing. They just made a declaration near the Kaaba that Makkah has been taken over. So Abdul Muttalib is like, okay, just like that. So what happened? Now, obviously, on one hand, Abdul Muttalib sees that, okay, Makkah has been taken over, this declaration has been done. And on the other hand, Abdul Muttalib sees that, hey, this person hasn't damaged anything. He hasn't hurt anyone. He respected the Kaaba. Person came there, the army came there, they still respected the Kaaba. They did not do anything. With all due respect, they took over Makkah. Right? So, now the new ruler is here. So now what happened is that Abdul Muttalib said, okay, I will go and talk to him. He told his people, I will go and speak with him. So he took a delegation from Makkah first to greet him as the new ruler, because now he's the new ruler established in Yemen. So all the people from around the world are now, you know, approaching him with delegations, sending delegations to honor him and to welcome him as the new ruler, as was the habit in those days and the custom in those days. So Abdul Muttalib also says, we need to go there and speak with him. So they went, Abdul Muttalib went there. As he went there, he did not take the main road. He went from the back side of the road, meaning, you know, back roads and side roads, until he reached Yemen. When he reached Yemen, he found out that the ruler, Saif, he was on a vacation. Right? Now, the vacation that he used to have is from Nowruz. Nowruz is the springtime, March 21st. He would take a vacation and close down the whole kingdom for 40 days. So, 40 days, everything is closed down. No official business, nothing. Everyone is in a month-long siesta. Right? Just relaxing and enjoying, nothing happening in those days, right? That's what's going on. Abdul Muttalib comes during that time, finds out that this person is on a vacation. He has gone to his vacation home. It's a palace called Ghamdan. Now this Ramadan palace, which is a very well known palace, is his vacation home, and he goes there for vacation. So this king is in vacation, and when the king goes for vacation, no one is going to bother him. That's the rule. No one can bother him, not even his children. They said if anyone wants to come inside, if they force them inside, just kill them. Right? Because it is my time off. Now, talk about a vacation, you know. No one can bother you. And you go on a vacation like that. So this is the king's vacation, and he's in his palace, and no one can bother him. So now Abdul Muttalib reaches the palace. He knows he can't take the main road, so he took a side road to the palace. He comes up to the main door of the palace, and he speaks to the guard there. He says, hey, listen, I need to meet the king. Would you let him know that I'm here? The guard just looks at him. He says, listen, you know, you're the wrong address. No, I mean, I'm here to meet the king. Would you go inside and let him know that I'm here? He says, listen, if I take this news inside, I will be killed. Right? I can't bother the king. Right? There's no way it's going to happen. Abdul Muttalib understands. He says, I understand. So he goes back to his camel, brings a big basket of gold, 100 pieces of gold, wraps it up and opens it up in front of the guard. Guard looks at all the gold And obviously, it's a lot of money in those days. 100 gold pieces means, man, this is your retirement. Right? He can take this and retire. Get some livestock, you know, 40 acres and a mule and retire. You know? That's what he's going to get with that. That's a lot of money there, right? So what happened is that he takes that, he's like looking at that, and he says, but still, what's the use of money if I'm going to be killed? Abdul Muttalib tells him that, listen, you will not be killed, I assure you of that. I will protect you. If anything is given to you, any punishment is given to you, I will take you in my refuge and say, they'll have to kill me first. When he heard the confidence in Abdul Muttalib, and Abdul Muttalib also was very, as I said, a very prestigious personality. When you actually see him, everyone would look up to him. They would like look at a person who is very grand, very big. Not big in size, but big in dignity and honor. So obviously, when he hears Abdul Muttalib, he's impressed. You know, he's like, okay. You know, so he goes inside and he's scared. He goes inside and tells the king that someone is here to meet you. And the king, and now he's expecting the worst. He's expecting, you know, I mean, he's going to be attacked and assaulted by the king and his guards and all these things. All of a sudden, he sees that the king's reaction is what surprised him. The king says, I've been waiting for him. Bring him inside. You're waiting for him? Okay, you know, so he goes out there and he says, hey, you know, I don't know what happened. This is the first time it's happening, but he's waiting for you. So Abdul Muttalib goes inside, meets the king. The king like, I was waiting for you. Come inside. Sit next to me. And then before Abdul Muttalib can say anything, he says, listen, right? There is a son, and I have read many books. I have read the books of the prophets. I have learned the knowledge of the prophets of the past, and I've seen the signs, and I've been all of this. I've accumulated the information, and I tell you that there is a child that is born in Makkah who is the promised one. He says, do you know him? Now, obviously, Abdul Muttalib, you know, doesn't want to say anything out loud or openly or clearly, so he's trying to say that maybe, you know. He's like hiding it. The king looks at his expression, his facial expression, and says, it's your grandson, isn't it? He tells him that. Abdul Muttalib was like, yes, it is. Says, that's it. That's what I wanted to hear. And I've been waiting for you. And I've been waiting for this to happen for such a long time. And I knew that this was going to happen. And I've seen the signs, and I've heard about the signs. He's from Yemen. Remember, Zarqa was from Yemen also. The queen who prophesied about the conception of the prophet. All of these news is happening there. So now this person, as he hears this, as he sees Abdul Muttalib, he says, listen, I have something to give you as a gift. I'm here to give you as a gift to the people. Now to make this thing short, right? I don't want to take too long with the story. He says, I have something to give to you as a gift. Come to my court with your delegation. And I officially want to recognize you all. And so he goes there. Everyone goes there. It's a big, huge gathering that they have. Official invitation is given. A big gala that is given for everyone. All the delegation comes. The king, say, recognizes the delegation. Gives them lavish gifts. And now Abdul Muttalib, you know, he takes his gift. Then he says, what are the three gifts that you have for me? He says, that I will give you in private. So after the gathering, come to me at night. So he goes to the gathering. After the delegation leaves, everyone leaves. He goes to the king on a personal level, goes to his personal room. And the king says, I have three things that I have to give you. And I want you to give it as a gift to your grandson. Now these things are not like big, very important things. It's not like crucial or something like that. But these three gifts were with the prophet until the end of his life. Until the end of his life. these three things were with the prophet. So he gives them the gift. Now, obviously, in between that, as he's giving the gifts, because when Abdul Muttalib met the king, Saif, he saw that he had white hair. When he met him in the court, he saw that he has black hair. Abdul Muttalib was at first shocked by that. He says, wait a minute, how did your white hair turn into black? So the king, you know, shared his secret. He says, listen, you know, it's called hair dye. It's called hair dye, right? And Abdul Muttalib was more interested in that. You have some? The king shared it with him. And so the hair dye came to Makkah and it became a sunnah after that. A sunnah after that. And the Imams have said in their hadith that this king Saif was the first one to use hair dye. Right? And he brought it from where and whatever he brought it from, he got that. But that's where hair dye comes from. Alright? So now, as this was happening, when this happened there, so this king gives him these three gifts. What are these three gifts that he gives them? He gives him first a camel called Qasbah. Qasbah, the camel of the Prophet that was given to him, that the Prophet used to ride everywhere. In fact, the last khutbah that he gave in Hajj, which is called the khutbah of Hajjatul Wida, was given from atop of this camel called Qasbah. Right? This was the camel that was given by King Saif, and he gave it to him as a gift. Second thing that he gave him was a mule, right, that the Prophet used to have all the way through. The third thing he gave him was a horse by the name of Uqab. By the name of Uqab. And this was also with the Prophet until he left. All these things you see that the Prophet used, it was his camel given to him as a gift. And then as he gave this gift, he says, Abdul Muttalib, I am giving you this gift to give to your grandson, and let him know this. Let him know this. I won't be able to meet him. I don't know if I'll be able to meet him or not, but I will tell you this right now. Just be a witness to what I say, and I am testifying and giving shahadat that he is the final messenger of Allah.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Declaring that he is a Muslim and that he believes in the Prophet. You see, these are the people who have been through signs and through teachings of the Prophet and through teachings of great scholars have learned and have accepted the coming of the Prophet or the signs of the Prophet as their own. Abdul Muttalib comes back. As he comes back, now he did not take the Prophet on this trip. He left him with Abu Talib. He left him with Abu Talib as he comes back to Makkah. As he comes back to Makkah, people hear that he's coming back and he has spoken with the king and Makkah is now free and released and he's not under the rule of anyone else. So as he comes back to them, all the people are on the outskirts waiting. The Prophet was walking. He was only a child. He was walking with them and he stopped. He stopped and he sat on a stone waiting for his grandfather to come. When the grandfather came there, he did not want to meet anyone or greet anyone. Everyone was trying to greet him. He says, no, I don't want to greet anyone. I want to meet my grandson first. He said, and everyone said, well, he's back there. He left everyone and he ran towards his grandson until he came to him. And as he picked him up, then he said, now I'm relaxed that I have you next to me. This was his life with Abdul Muttalib. How close was Abdul Muttalib? Abdul Muttalib was not just a normal person. He was the king of the Arabs at that time, the chief of Makkah, that his rule was established for everyone in Makkah. They looked up to him on his greatness. Abdul Muttalib, now 81 years old, becomes sick. He falls ill. And then they take him from his house to his sitting place near the Kaaba. They take him near there. He goes near that place, is lying down. Now you see, no one is allowed to come and sit at that place. It was reserved for Abdul Muttalib. Even though there's no written rule, it was an unwritten rule. that no one sits at that place, no one goes near that place except for Abdul Muttalib. It is meant only for him. That's the honor that everyone in Makkah had bestowed on Abdul Muttalib. And the only one who was able to go there other than Abdul Muttalib was the Prophet. And when he went there the first time, it was Abu Jahl who became angry and started and stopped the Prophet by holding his hand and getting angry at him. And says, don't go there. As soon as he said that, Abdul Muttalib right away turned around and said, let go of him. He has more right to sit here than me. And no one will ever stop him from coming to this place. Abu Jahl stepped back. And after that, no one stopped him. At this time, when Abdul Muttalib was on really his deathbed, he was like unconscious. You saw that the Prophet was going towards there. So at this point, Abu Lahab thought that, you know what, I am going to stop him. He didn't like the fact that the Prophet is going there. And Prophet is just a kid. So he grabbed him. As soon as he grabbed him, Abdul Muttalib opened his eyes, mustered up his courage, and told Abu Lahab, let him be. And he told everyone, I want my grandson. Bring him to me. And Abdul Muttalib was having a very hard time at death. Very hard time at death. You know, some people die easy, some people die hard. Abdul Muttalib was someone who was dying hard. He wasn't letting go. When the Prophet was brought, he asked the Prophet to lie down on his chest. Prophet laid down on his chest. And everyone, the whole of Makkah is out there watching this. All of Makkah is watching this. And then he tells everyone that my wasiyat to you all is to guard and protect this grandson of mine. The grandson of mine, guard him. Then he says, I'm going to cast lots as to who my successor is. They cast lots over there and Abu Talib's name came. And he became the successor. And he called Abu Talib and told him, listen, you are my successor, but I want you to promise something. Abu Talib says, whatever, my father. He says, with all your life and all your resources, you are going to protect the life of this grandson of mine. Abu Talib already believed in the Prophet. And Abu Talib was like, yes, with all my life, I will protect him. With my children's life, I will protect him. Now everyone left. Abu Talib asked everyone to stay back. He just had the Prophet on his chest. He looked into the eyes of the Prophet and started to cry. Abdul Muttalib's life, 81 years of age, started in Medina as an orphan. Remember that. He had to be literally kidnapped from one side of the family and brought to the other side. He became the chief of Makkah at the age of 14, established his rule, discovered the well of Zamzam, established himself as a ruler of Makkah. That Abdul Muttalib, whose grandeur is known every day, that Abdul Muttalib is looking at the eyes of his grandson and he's asking this question and asking himself and speaking to his grandson and saying, my grandson, all of this that I have done in my life has been for you. Has been for you. And if I had to do it again, I would do it again. And everything was worth it. Abdul Muttalib was the first one to say, Fustu bi Rabbil Kaaba. Not in those words, but in that meaning. He says, everything was worth it. He looked at him with tears in his eyes and a smile on his face. That's how he passed away. And Rasulullah on his chest. Separation of now the Prophet from his grandfather. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the tawfiq and the blessing to be on the right path. Amen. Wisdom to understand his guidance. Amen. Hasten the reappearance of our Imam. Make us his helper when he comes. وآخر الدعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.